This is an interview with Jerry Tellier, November the 28th, 1974, the material to be used for a biography of Arthur Evans. Jerry, where do we begin? As a young man, when you were first in the relief camp?
That would be all right.
Okay, let's start there. What was some of your experience in the relief camp, and how young a man were you?
About 16, I guess.
Yeah.
And left Montreal, of course, during the Depression, and went to relief camps in Quebec and Ontario, and prairie camps too, Thunder and Saskatchewan, also in British Columbia, where a lot of relief camps were, and where most people who were unemployed in those days headed for the warmer climate in the winter months.
Before we get too much further, you're half of a very famous brother pair that many of us laugh about periodically, not at you, but with you. Which half of Winters and Summers were you?
Winters.
You were Winters. Mm. Very good. I interviewed the Summers then. Why were these names? Why did you not use your own names? Would you like to tell me part of that?
Well, I did use my own name in the first relief camp I was ever in St. John's, Quebec. It's about 30 some odd miles from Montreal in the Eastern Township. And we had a strike in the relief camp. And I was fired, I guess, from this 20-cent a day relief camp along with others, and I found that it would be to my advantage were I not to use my proper and my right name. So that time on, I used the various names and relief camps that I went in, because I was always interested in abolishing the relief camps and getting work.
You were blacklisted then with your own name, and every time you
got
blacklisted, you would change it to another name.
That's true. Yeah, I went under the name of Spring and Summers and Knight, Jack Knight, and other names.
Was this your first experience with trade unionism?
It was.
And that was being a member of a union of unemployed, is that right?
The first union that I ever belonged to was called the Relief Camp Workers Union.
Right. You were here in 34 prior to the first coming out on strike?
Yes, I was. First one.
And did you come out and strike in the fall or the winter of
34? December of 1934, I came out of the relief camp at Revelsville on strike. In fact, I was an organizer for the Relief Camp Workers Union then.
Had you met my father by this time?
Yes, I had.
And he was an organizer through the Workers Unity League?
He was, assisting the unemployed.
Very good. Well, you went back to the camp. Could you tell me why you went back at that particular time?
Yes, we did. It was in the middle of winter and we got nowhere. And we found the best, in order to make it successful, the springtime would be the better time. We had a convention in Kamloops in February of 1935. Early in February or late January, I'm not too sure of the date, around that period. And we decided, the Relief Camp Workers Union decided, that we would go back to the camps, reorganize, come out in the spring again, and bring them all out of the relief camps, because some of the older ones were reluctant to leave the camps in the middle of winter. And although
the majority, though, of the men in the camps were young, disenfranchised youths.
Right. They were from all over Canada, and Britain, and immigrants.
And they were isolated, poor wages.
20 cents a day.
The bunk houses you lived in?
Oh, yes. Yes. Tar paper shacks, we called them. And they were. That's what they were.
How about your hygienic facilities?
Outhouses.
And the decision was made to organize to get all of the men out of the camps, and that
the date
happened.
Was set for April 1st, the 4th of April. And the first ones to come out were the top camps, that is at the end of the road, like Revelstoke to the camp 58 miles called Goldstream. Other areas, like the whole Princeton, the top camp, the furthest one from Princeton, because the whole Princeton was not built. It wasn't connected from Princeton to Hope at all. And the whole band was a camp, I believe the number was 213. That was the closest one to Hope. So therefore we had the good people that ensured that we get most militant in the top camp as part of our strategy. And also in other areas, in the Kootenays, the same thing applied. We would start at the top camp and when the date was set, men knew about it. We had a camp paper, we called it the camp book, and it was well publicized. And it was done by volunteers. Out of our $5 a month, 20 cents a day, we contributed so much toward keeping up the newspaper so the men would be aware of what was going on and what would be the best way that we could institute a program or get the government to institute a program of work and wages.
You had, prior to this, sent delegations to Victoria, to Ottawa, and tried to deal with the mayor in Vancouver to
civic,
get support.
Provincial and federal, yes. We tried at all levels of government.
Had the McDonald Commission been called by this time, or was it just around that time that looked into the relief camp workers? I have a copy of their findings that if you had a few more books and lights a little later at night, that there would be no problem. That they were, the food was fine, the clothes were fine, and it was quite a nice place to be.
Well, I don't go along with that at all, because I'm firmly convinced of the policy of the governments in those days at all levels, civic, provincial, and federal. They passed the buck from one to the other. And they wanted us out of their sight and out of their way, so they had us in these relief camps that were isolated from everyone. They wanted to bury the fact that there were over 1 million unemployed in Canada, employables who could work and could not get any work because out of the total population of approximately 10 million people at that, that time.
Yes, that's a very sad thing to say about our country. Your decision was made, you came into Vancouver, and from what you say, presumably that was to make the citizens aware of your plight, because the governments to this time had done absolutely nothing to improve your situation.
That's right.
Could you tell me some of the things you did in Vancouver to make yourselves known and to get support for the boys?
Yes, I can recall one instance in particular that impressed me very much. We had an artist, I can't recall the person's name, yes, it's Tiny something. The day after the mayor of Vancouver, Jerry McGeer, G.G. McGeer, read the riot act at Victory Square, this man conceived the idea of running off a leaflet with a picture of Jerry McGeer, with a cenotaph in the background, with a pair of wings and a halo around his head.
And swastika on the boots. I have a copy of that.
And we also, we distributed them to the people walking in Vancouver. I stood on street corners and handed them out to them. And also, we had tin cans who were shaking cans, asking for donations in order to keep us going.
There was a May Day parade. They tell me the largest that was ever held in Vancouver.
That's right.
I have been given figures, 17,000 and
all of that. Oh my God. Longshoremen's Union came out. I can recall all the time. We met, we gathered in Stanley, we went to Stanley Park that day, and also on Mother's Day we went to Stanley Park too, and they did parade with tremendous success, and people from all over the whole mainland actually came out.
And what kind of a support did you get from the average working Joe, if there were a few around in Vancouver, from the average citizen? Were they sympathetic?
Very good. Loggers, and miners, fishermen, workmen, workers who happened to be fortunate enough to be working with, why, they would give us money, they would give us all their change. Some even would put a dollar bill, in those days a dollar bill was a lot of money. And they would even put that into the collection can. And this kept us going. We had a committee that looked after the funds and also distributed it. What we had, we shared meal tickets, and we had people that were going out getting old clothing. And people would phone in. We had a telephone. We had a place in Cordova Street. 31A Cordova, if I remember the address, and 52 Cordova West. And we got terrific support from all working people, because they were facers. Well, they were just a hair's breadth away from the same conditions that we had to live under.
You also so supported trade unionists who were out in strike at various places.
Yes,
I'm thinking of Fraser Mills, which may have been a little earlier than that period. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of longshoremen. And also, I think there was a parade. Did they not stop work for an hour or so in support of your problems?
Longshoremen did. Yes, they did. In those days, I believe the leaders of the longshoremen union were Ivan Emery and Oscar Sloan. And they had a seaman section, the IBU, the part of the longshoremen in those days, if I remember right. They had a little place at the foot of Main Street, a little hall there, and they too, I believe it was Local 5, if I'm not mistaken, called Local 5, and we got terrific support from the longshoremen, so we in turn supported them, and they were up against it.
Was there, to your knowledge, any occasion of a relief camp worker ever doing scab duty?
No, I do not know of any.
You were well trained in trade union philosophy then, were you?
Well,
even though
yes.
You didn't have a job.
We were, that's true. We were conditions forces to think. We realized that the only way we could ever get anything was by sticking together, not by scabbing on a man who happened to be working.
Jerry McGeer and some of his cohorts made much of damage that happened in the Hudson's Bay. And that, I believe, was the same day that he read the Riot Act. Could you explain to me, if you know, what was that man's philosophy? Why would he have turned the police against men whose only wish was to get work and wages?
Jerry McGeer was the liberal politician, if I remember rightly. He was a liberal, and he was solely interested in the businessman, not in the working man. He didn't, he gave no support whatever. Whenever delegations went up to the city hall, that time it was the Holden building on Hastings Street, and he had no time to carry the gear. The unemployed, he would tell us that there was going to Victoria's, he'd duck the pillow. And we, whenever we went to Victoria with delegations, we were told, well, it was the responsibility of the federal government. R.B. Bennett was the top down then.
And what was your philosophy as far as your approach to the general public? How were you trying to win their support? I'm thinking of what was your attitude to the general public. Also, you were in the museum and held it for a few hours. Were you very careful to give your best foot forward? Did you have discipline to make you proud of who you were and to try and elicit support from people?
Absolutely. This is one of the main reasons why we received the support. We were not the ones who The damage was done mostly when we were attacked in the prior under by the police. Scanlon was head of the Mounted Police of Vancouver at the time, and Handlebar Hank, I think we called him, and they were the ones who would stop. How else could we go to the show the people that we meant business, that we wanted jobs and able to live a decent life and so on, the same as
What do you feel was the maximum sum of unemployed who were in Vancouver at any one time through that period? Are we talking 1,000, 2,000, 3,000? About how many men unemployed were in Vancouver?
Well, I don't know, but in relief camps, I don't know the number of, I can't offhand the number of relief camps we had in British Columbia, but, thousands.
So if these thousands of men had any idea of causing damage, you certainly had a large enough body to have done it.
Had we wanted the damage, we could have destroyed everything in the city of Vancouver because we were so well organized, but our policy was not that. It was not destruction. Our policy was to get the government to look after the unemployed people and to give us jobs at decent wages and not hurt us like cattle in the slave camps.
My father, part of his philosophy always was that a working man doesn't destroy something built with his own labor.
That's true. Working people build things.
And somewhere along the way, a decision was made that something else had to be done. Do you have any knowledge as to how that came about, or when the decision was made? What was the decision to?
That we, you mean the trek to Ottawa?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had attempted time and time again at the civic level, at the provincial level, and finally they said it was a federal responsibility. The camps were run by the Department of National Defense, which was federal. The clothing that we had was discarded army clothing. It was,
the First World War, 1918.
First World War boots, right. With the iron heels and so on. And Mackinaw jackets, and also we had the khaki dungarees, or khaki pants, khaki shirts, khaki sweater. The socks weren't khaki, about all I guess. And you could always tell a person in a relief camp in the city of Vancouver that came from the camp by the clothing he wore. That's all he had, was the riding on his back that were government discards from the First War. And after we had left, we left Vancouver to go to Ottawa because we had exhausted every means, and we were told that the decision that Ottawa was the only way we could be straightened out. So finally, we decided that we would go to Ottawa, and we did. We went to about as far as Regina. But there were others, relief camps in Ontario, Manitoba, unemployed people, who also were organizing at the same time. And they too, we were going to link up with people from Winnipeg. And also there were people from the Toronto area and so on that were going to converge on Ottawa. CRV Bennett from there. Get us settled once and for all, the abolition of the relief camps and institution of the program working wages.
You got to Regina and the delegation of eight went to CRB Bennett.
That's right. That is correct. That happened in Texas. We tried to get out of Regina on trucks, you see, and I can recall I was one of them that was on a truck to the Reverend East, his name was Sam East. I was on the same truck. We got a couple of miles out of Regina, and the Mounted Police had erected a barricade across the road, transplanted the highway. And the truck stopped, the mounted police, bango, they started swimming to the clubs and so on. We took off across the prairies and made our way back to Regina. Some were arrested, I can't recall the name, I believe Reverend East was arrested, he was assaulted too. Incidentally, he was elected mayor of Regina in the elections that same year that were held, the civic election.
And then we come to the day that I'm sure is well implanted in your mind, July the 1st, and I believe that you were the chairman of a meeting in Market Square. Could you tell me what that meeting was for and what you remember of that evening?
It was called on Dominion Night, Dominion Day. We were leaving about 7 o'clock at night, I think. Beautiful night too, and mostly the people there in attendance were people that lived in Regina and the surrounding area that came to the meeting to know what was going on and to find out just what this was all about, because we had been stalled in Regina for quite some time, and at the same time they were giving us their support and produce and so on, and people are around cooking and everything. And the night of July 1st, the mounted police and the city police of Regina attacked the meeting. Tear gas, clubs swinging.
Was there any justification for their attack, to your knowledge?
None whatever. I happened to be the one who was appealing for funds at the time when the riot did actually start. I was asked if they were going to take up a collection. And the mounted police attacked the meeting, and that was the beginning of the riot. The damage that was done would have been avoided, and also policeman had lost his life that night, that also would have been avoided had they not attacked that meeting and provoked us into retaliation. And how the policeman got killed, I don't know. He was in plain clothes from what I understand, and I happened to be at his funeral several days later. And it's the only time in my life, and I don't think it's ever happened before or since to my knowledge, that the casket being borne down the main street of Regina, people were standing along the sidewalk booing him.
He was the gentleman, was he not, that blew the whistle?
That is the person that blew the whistle. His name was Miller.
There were men injured that night, men shot.
That's right.
And
badly beaten and clubbed too, and trampled by the horses.
Men were in the hospital and men were arrested.
Yes, right.
Not a very glorious page in Canada's history, is it?
No, especially on Canada Day, Dominion Day.
You boys from the camp, finally there was a decision made that you would disband and you would go back to the areas that either you came from or wished to go to.
That's right.
Do you feel out of your unemployed activities, you're going to Ottawa, do you think it has made any lasting changes in Canada's history?
Well, it's a black page in the history of Canada where the mounted police, where R.B. Bennett, I guess he must have given the orders, and the delegation went down to Ottawa to explain the case of the unemployed, but we found out subsequently that this was a stalling tactic, that he had no intention whatever of solving the problem of the unemployed or instituting a program of work and wages, and it was a delaying tactic to give them time to so they could amass all the police they could throw all across Canada, I think, to stop us at Regina and to start this bloodbath that happened that night.
Well, R.B. Bennett was not elected at the last election. I suppose that's something good that came out of it. There certainly were, by many elected officials, by newspapers, by ministers, a great push to have the young men of Canada not follow some of the leaders because they had a red tinge. There's no doubt about that. Well, my father did. Did it bother you?
No, not at all. I didn't care whether a person was black or white or yellow or whatever color of his skin or his politics. He was entitled to the good things in life, the same as, or we were already willing and able to work for it. All we wanted was the opportunity to work and to get paid for our work.
And also, you men made decisions through your strategy committees. There were delegates from various parts of your unemployed workers, and it wasn't always a one-man decision.
It was not a one-man decision. It was, we held meetings, daily meetings, of every division before the trek to Ottawa, and while on the trek to Ottawa. There were committees, we had social committee, we had food committee, publicity committee, recreation committee. We had all these committees, and no one man made the decision. No. But there were some who were outstanding people that gave us a tremendous help, whether they were communists or didn't matter what their politics were, because their heart was in the right place. That was the main thing.
And this was a trade union organization.
It was a trade union organization. As it was called, the Reef Camp Workers Union. Received the support from the Workers Unity League. Arthur Evans was one of the leaders of the Workers Unity League. Was one of the leaders of our trek and the trek to Ottawa, and prior to the trek to Ottawa also. And gave us support all along the line, and he was well liked, well respected by those who were on that trek, because he did a terrific job for us.
Very nice to hear. Is there anything else that you would like to tell me about this specific period that I may not have touched on that you have knowledge of? Anything that would be interesting perhaps to a history buff who would like to?
Yes, I could give you I recall, I'll never forget it, Golden it was. We stopped there at Golden. Of course, we traveled by boxcars and from Vancouver. We stopped at some different places along the line. And at Golden, we had an advance committee also that they would prepare the area for the coming of the trekkers. So at Golden, cooked out with stews and held in a park on the outskirts of Golden and camping ground that thing. And we got out of the freight train stop at Golden. We went to very orderly, with so many huge boxcars, lined top to the boxcars. And we gathered and marched through Golden, through the little town of Golden, to this place. And people there had arranged a meal for us. It was stew, mutton stew. And Arthur Evans gave a speech after and said it was a fine stew that we had, and some of it was burnt. But it was a cookout. But it was very good too. We were hungry.
There's an old friend of my father's, Mrs.
Hungry.
Sorley, that was the lady in Golden, and very nice. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tellier, and may I have permission to use what is on this tape for my father's biography?
Yes, you sure can. I give you my full permission.
Thank you very much.
If anything I can add to it, if I think of anything I'm badly, pretty touchy.
thank you again.
All the help possible, because he deserves to be written about, because he's a man among men, this fellow.
Well, I knew him as a father. You see him in a different
way. Well, I was only a kid, but I sure found out that he was a man.
Thank you very much.